Right, just get this on tape. Talking to Robin Blazer on, what's his day, the 14th or the 15th?
15th.
15th of October. 16th. It's Sunday, anyway. I'll check that out.
16th.
1994, in case somebody's transcribing this 10 years from now. in the Durant Hotel in Berkeley, California. Right. And what I specifically wanted to ask you about was anything at all that you remember, first of all, about Jack Spicer's association with KPFA, and if you know anything about how he met the people involved and how he himself became involved.
Well, I couldn't be really specific about it, except that KPFA made a big splash here in 49-50, mm-hmm. before the loyalty oath thing mm-hmm. going on. And it drew everybody's attention, for one, because it was a public intellectuality that we had not previously participated mm-hmm. in. Mm-hmm. And Jack and Duncan both went for this strongly. Now, Jack must have talked... my sense was that Richard Moore was the real connection for Jack Spicer and for Robert Duncan, that it was through Richard Moore that they were able to argue for certain programs, the poetry programs, which would be Duncan, Jack himself, the early poems, of course, in those days, and Madeline Gleason, and, Bill Everson, as he was then mm-hmm. and is again.
Brother Antoninus.
I'm forgetting some of the names because it was a rather large run of people. And I've always been, in these late years, rather disturbed that only certain people get mentioned when it was an enormous intellectual... Mm-hmm.
Was Ruth Diamant involved
Ruth
by
Witt
this time?
Yes, Ruth Witt Diamant was still around here. Now, Ruth Witt Diamant, as far as I know, did not have much to do with KPFA. Her bailiwick was this poetry center that mm-hmm. she managed to set up at San Francisco State.
Yeah. So you don't recall any specific tie-in between the poetry center and KPFA,
no.
but only of the people.
Of the people, and then it was being done personally and the program set up personally. Mm-hmm. Now, Jack's program was not so much in that, in my memory of it, and his excitement about KPFA was not so much in the poetry as in a folk song program. It was ballads and folk songs that he was interested in, and he would get on this program, and he had Jim Herndon, who is now dead. His wife is still, his first wife, Fran Herndon, the painter, is in San Francisco, and his second wife, Arpine, both of them are still around. Arpine, I don't know that would know much about this, but Fran Herndon would remember this, I'm quite sure, though Jim was not then married, but Jack had him coming in with his guitar. He was quite good at strumming the guitar, in a sort of a straightforward way, mm-hmm. with the basic chords and all that, and Jack would rewrite the ballads mm-hmm. to put dirty words and stuff in, and battle with Jim Herndon all the time to make him sing these. Jim didn't think it was proper to say some of these things on radio, and Jack was constantly pushing the edge. Then he added to this labor songs, and the one that he particularly liked to get Jim to do was God Damn Their Eyes. It's a marvelous labor song. Jack had brought in a lot of the old wobbly kind of stuff because his father had been connected with the Wobblies, and he brought this material and got Jim Herndon to do it. So you had the folk songs, and we didn't have a lot of folk singers around, and the program was very lively, very funny.
Do you remember Stan Wilson?
I do not, no. Well,
he was a black folk singer who later went on to Hungry Eye and did some recordings.
Oh.
But he was on KPFA at an early stage, and I didn't know whether it could have possibly have been through Jack.
I think that this may be a little more sophisticated than was Jack's program. Jack's was homemade in some way, mm-hmm. picking out the famous and great ballads and so on. I mean, it was wonderful, but it was very much Jack's constant stirring the pot, what later he would call magic, that business of never allowing anything to be still. So that even if you had a classic ballad that he would play with it in some way, so it would do something. I wish we had records of these. When I contacted KPFA in the 70s, when I was doing the collected books of Jack Spicer, they told me that there were no records, that the tapes were not kept. And I suppose another search.
They were expensive. They had to get used over again, or there were no programs.
Or they also disintegrated because the tapes were terrible in those days.
Yeah, but more often were reused than disintegrated.
I'm afraid that's the case, because it was very, very. But that's the fundamental program that I listened to and listened. That is listened to as Jack preparing it and quarreling with Jim Herndon about how far they could go with the language, and a constant kind of attack on any sentimentality about the folk tradition. He was going to take it back into a kind of tough, hard edge, and of course that was also where he added the wobbly songs and so on. Goddamn Their Eyes was wonderful, and Jim could sing it beautifully.
Yeah, you know, there's a wonderful IWW anthology that came out a number of years ago out of one of the Midwestern University presses, Michigan or Minnesota.
Oh.
Great big fat coffee table sized book, about that thick, of it's just an anthology of writings from IWW publications and songs and.
Goodness! Yeah. Now, I bet this is. Do you have any? Do you remember the date at all?
Well, it's going back, getting on 20 years or something like that.
20 years.
I don't remember exactly. I've only seen one copy of it, which I bought at an anarchist book fair in London a couple of years ago. And I promptly, being a man of conscience, I promptly gave it to Eric Mottram, who I told you about,
yes,
who was working on that period and who practically got down on his knees and blessed me for doing so.
Well,
but I felt it had to be used, not sitting on my shelf.
I'll watch for it, because I think it must have been 20 years ago. You say, well, that would be
the cover is, of course, bright red. Solid red.
Right, perfect. Because that circle, the strange relations there you've discussed in your pamphlet, the relationship with the pacifists, and there were, and Jack too had many friends. We all did, friends that were within the. Richard Moore was a pacifist, as I recall. Yeah.
Did I tell you that I'm talking to Richard Moore?
Yes,
Tuesday. I'm driving out to Point Arena,
like
staying
the
overnight
idea of
there.
That so much that you were going up to see him, and please greet him.
I will.
We've not seen one another for so many years. But then there was also Kenneth Rexroth's anarchist group that circles in here. And that is through that group that Jack met Duncan.
Uh-huh.
Jack,
I have to stick in here, by the way, that this Eric Mottram, whom I keep plugging, edited the Kenneth Rexroth Reader, which came out in England about 20 years ago.
Oh, my.
And he was a close friend.
Kenneth.
So I've got to get you onto Rexroth. Well, I mean onto Mottram.
Well, you're going to. In fact, I think I'll just make a note right now. That's a double T, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. I will look into this, because I love little. These are serendipities. They're gifts, you see, that come out like this. I will certainly check that.
All of culture does this. If you pursue anything from this point in any direction, and ultimately you find yourself back there again.
It entwines.
Yeah.
My favorite word for it is folding. I mean, the thing that you keep, and every time something comes up here, you fold in another connection, so that it's bigger than certainly my 18-year-old eyes.
And it's not totally unrelated to Mandelbrot diagrams and chaos.
Oh, I think a great deal to do with it. The upper side of chaos theory. Yes.
But anyway, now, at what point do you recall Jack's getting into poetry broadcasting on the station? contemporary plot.
My memory, and this is, could be a slip, but my memory is that it's very early. Mm-hmm. And the if I am right, that it's really Richard Moore, is one, it's both Jack and Duncan. Mm-hmm. Duncan was 7 years older than Jack and I.
I have to say again that Eric Mottram is one of Robert Duncan's closest friends.
I may. This is curious because I may well have met him over the years, but there were people that the way my relationships went, I was often over here when there was a lot of action going on elsewhere. Yeah. And
anyway, this is the last time I will mention the name of Eric Mottram.
Well, I've taken this guy. I'm going to put an asterisk on Eric Mottram's name to say, look
well,
up.
If you have an asterisk, that's a good place to risk it.
That's a good risk to take. That's a very good bud. And it was that kind of group of poets who were made up of those poets who were both San Francisco and Berkeley, who were around a thing called the what was the name of that? They kicked us out. It was a literary meeting group that we had on the campus. And the English department sort of tolerated all of this. It was Tom Parkinson.
I was going to say Tom Parkinson.
Josephine Miles, and Mark Schorer. Mm-hmm. And when it came time to battle over bringing Henry Miller, they objected. And then a young man named Montague, who became an extraordinarily important mathematician, and wrote some stories about very, very homosexual stories about making it in the back seat of a car, and we were going to publish it in our little magazine for which Ben Lehman had given me money, $25, to publish this little thing, and we called it Literary Behavior, Guess Why. Kinsey Report had just come out. Well, anyway, we were not allowed to bring Henry Miller, we were not allowed to published Montague stories, and when I tried to locate those stories in later years, the reply was that they'd been destroyed. They were extraordinary. They were beyond Henry Miller. And in those days,
they had probably gone to earth, as it were.
Gone to earth. And in those days, you know, we read Henry Miller under the counter. It was Olympia Press edition.
Yes, of course. Yeah.
And I think a lot of this kind of split up in some way, according, at least this would be in my terms, but I think it was also true of Jack, not true for Duncan. Rex Roth entered an absolutely crazy homophobic period where there would be terrible scenes in the bars in San Francisco.
My God.
I told his biographer about this when she wanted to come up to Vancouver to interview me. I said, you know, I wound up not knowing Kenneth Rex Roth very well because I didn't know what to do with this. Not these days, I'd kick him in the balls, but in those days, I didn't know what to do, 18, 19 years old, and all of this going on.
Do you have any idea why?
I do not know why, and no one ever knew why. Duncan could never explain it, though Duncan maintained the long friendship with Kenneth through all of this. Rather as though he were immune. I think Duncan's view was that it was just another wild side of Rex Roth, that one wouldn't take it as an ideology of some kind. Mm-hmm. It certainly didn't have any religious overtones. It was just something that would break out every so often and scared me to death. Scared the shit out of me, as a matter of fact. And so it rather broke that up. But all of us continued to listen carefully to Kenneth Rex Roth's book review program. Yeah. It was marvelous.
Yeah. I mean, one can make some sort of an intellectual argument in favor of such a position, some kind of an argument, but the impoverishing thing is that, quite aside from the rights and wrongs of it, you have suddenly cut off like half of the culture of America.
it was very peculiar here. Of course, we were so much younger than Kenneth, but Duncan 7 years older than we were. But it was a Jack had sent poems to Kenneth, and there's some correspondence between him and Kenneth Rexroth of real interest. I think those have been published. But then it stopped, because what would you do? I mean, he was writing poems like One Night Stand and so on. Well, you're not going to send those. Kenneth's book reviews, though, were marvelous, because they went everywhere. You never knew what on earth he was going to... The joke was that he would review some of these things just to get the book for his library. Well, that's not fair, because that's the kind of thing people would say. He wound up telling us about books we would never otherwise have found. And they were all great readers, but we wouldn't have found them without Kenneth's help. And the other marvelous thing about
he was a Lewis and Clark of the Lewis book world.
Lewis and Clark, and well, you know, we were here. The war is on. We all arrive here. I arrive in 1944. Jack comes in 1945, and then we wind up meeting Duncan. Jack meets him at Kenneth Rexroth's anarchist group and brings him to me. A man named Gene Wall, a great and marvelous man, a musician, composer, who was a bit deaf, so he spent his time on the F train, as we then called that way of getting to San Francisco, hitting the tuning fork on his knee and trying to memorize notes in order to make up for his hearing disability. We had, during that late war period, when we all appeared here, we all used Cyril Connolly's Horizon. That was the big source of being in contact with the international poetry movement. And I always like to sort of point out that, quite frankly, one didn't, in my experience, and I think it is true for a great many others, one did not get into the 20th century until about that time. You weren't in the 20th century. You were by the shores of Gitche Gumee. And Jack had was first to discover Yeats, and then we had Duncan. Duncan had been in New York and had met many of the surrealists, and it was and knew Charles Henry Ford and all of this stuff, and he brings all this back. And then there's George Late, whom you may have known, who published Circle magazine. This is all circling around the same period that KPFA makes its appearance. And it becomes just a rich, well, it's a carpet. And considering, as I remember, Kenneth Rexroth reviewing a book on Persian history or something, I think of it as a Persian carpet, this whole thing. In the meantime, of course, you're not really well off in the English department. We had our own, Throckmorton was a building down here on Telegraph where Duncan lived. And we studied our Finnegan's Wake there on our own. You couldn't do it at the university. Garcia Lorca, Mallarmé, and so on. And
you were lucky if you got beyond Beowulf in the English department in those days.
Well, and we did marvelously with Beowulf, actually. Spicer and I competed in our translations with a wonderful scholar named Brodeur.
Brodeur. Oh, yes. He was, remember anglicized as Brodeur.
Yes. Brodeur, and people were always saying Brodeur was the original name. Yeah. But Brodeur was a wonderful old English teacher. Yeah. Well, we're not, the interview doesn't involve all the marvels that you found at the university. Duncan never finished his BA.
I'm just pursuing this serendipitous line and assuming we'll get back here anyway.
Well, I just kind of, because my main point was that KPFA, at least from my point of view, became just a marvelous part of that carpet of things that brought us into the 20th century. The battle, the pacifist connection, for example, which was always there, and among the people that you met, it was not, as I remember, anything that the KPFA pushed. It was that it was there, and the people who represented it were there to speak of it, and it began to influence all of us, because we had what was going to come up pretty soon. If we had not been drafted, we would then they'd go after us for Korea.
Yeah.
When the decision came on Korea, you had a very different attitude towards what these wars meant, had you been listening to these people, Jack and Duncan particularly.
Right.
I mean, I remember my my.
Again, it's impossible to within the KPFA context to separate the art side from the political side. As it is so easy to do, you know, elsewhere.
I don't think they didn't. No, you couldn't separate it there. That's interesting. That's really what I. That was what I was trying to say. That somehow you began.
Even
to
somebody like Phil Elwood, you know, who did the jazz programs, you know, forever and ever, and is still doing them. I talked to him for 4 hours yesterday. and Elwood, I knew in a general way, but I found out specifically he came out of a strong Norman Thomas socialist Berkeley background himself, and was on the verge of being a conscientious objector himself, and all of his friends were CEOs, so that even he, as a jazz expert and fan, was part of the socialist left context of Berkeley.
Yes, we had great difficulty going out to listen to Wallace, for example, and joining a Trotskyite group run by a man named Robin Bauer.
Oh, yes, that's a familiar name.
I got kicked out of there for a joke that Jack got me to go ahead. It was my idea, but he said, do it. And we were at a meeting of a total of maybe 11 or 12 people, and a hand went up and said, I move we ban supernaturalist religions. And Jack said, Robin, and I stood up and said, I am papal nuncio for this area. They threw me out. I was never allowed at the Trotskyite meetings again.
Do you remember a Trotskyite that used to hang around the coffee shops at that time? A terribly intense guy with a marvelous sort of stentorian voice that was always delivering lectures, spontaneous. His first name was Alex. This is 1952, but he'd been around for a while at that point.
I don't remember him.
I'm just wondering, because he's one of the guys that I used to sit and listen to, mesmerized.
Yes, of course, we all were trying to figure this out. I mean, you get to the point where, you know, what is left of the left when you get through thinking this over. A lot is left of the left, as a matter of fact, but we haven't yet found out what to do with it. It was the richest possible time for young people, young men and women, and there were some splendid women here, and painting was going on all this time. And in fact, Robert Duncan's relation with Jess begins in 1950, all of this. And recently, because they borrowed my Jess paintings for his big retrospective traveling around the big American museums, I got out things that had been in storage. The first paintings I ever bought, Lynn Brockway, she was then Lynn Braun, is still here, still painting, but I got out these two magnificent abstracts that I hadn't had up for years. It was in painting and in music and in writing, one entered the 20th century. By way of, and KPFA for me is fundamental to that entrance.
Yeah, and we were halfway into the 20th century.
Yes, and
you've
not
point.
Been there before. I had not been there before.
Very few people.
Duncan was ahead of us. He'd been to New York and hit the big town, and then George Lait's magazine, which is a very interesting magazine to look back at, the Circle it was called.
Right. Yeah.
And the first far out bookstore was called Dalziel's, and it was on Telegraph Avenue.
God, I don't remember that.
That was before Campus Textbook Exchange.
See, I was in the English department at that time, and I'm looking at early 1950s, and a very an undergraduate student English department, and a very loyal, enthusiastic supporter of classic English literature, as one was supposed to be. And my my association, I didn't listen to KPFA in those days, and my association into the avant-garde poetry scene only came by way of, finally, by about 1956, I started dating a poetess, named Carol Christopher Drake, who was a member of a San Francisco group that called themselves the Seven Stray Cats.
This is 56.
It's 56. And as a result of that, I appear in two or three of the photographs in that photographic collection, I Am a Lover. Uh-huh. That do you remember that?
Yes.
Evan Connell. Is that right, Evan?
I'm not sure.
The writer. Who selected quotations, and they were interspersed with these photographs.
And you're there.
Yeah.
Oh, what a wonderful time. I'm
prominently there on a couple of facing pages. You know. But
I'm curious about, and this is where I think it would be interesting for your future work on KPFA, I do not know where KPFA stood. Not in any detail. It seems to me that they were very good about letting the voices of opposition show up on KPFA, but I don't have a clear memory of when the Loyaltyals came in 1950. You see, this is another breaking point. Spicer refuses to sign as a teaching assistant and leaves for Minneapolis. He comes back in a year's time, but he goes to Minneapolis. Wow.
Because I did a creative writing class with him in 1952 or 53.
Oh, he was doing that 52 or 3 here?
Here.
Yeah. Yes, that was that one. The English department allowed a single course, and Josephine Miles really ran that thing, and Jack got, I'd forgotten that Jack got to do a creative writing course. That must have been something.
Yeah, it was. I wasn't ready for it. I didn't appreciate it at all. I wasted my time in it.
Did he write sonnets?
Oh, I don't think so. No.
He might not have done that.
Yeah. And I was in a very I think I even took an incomplete in the course. I was in a very lazy period in my life. And I was a vegetable.
Well, Jack was initial in many ways, too. Those early poems are brilliant. But Jack was in, by the time, you see, you brought up 56. Well, by the time of 56, I've gone to Harvard and with a job. Mm-hmm. And Jack has tried to go to New York and winds up joining me in Boston. Then comes back here in 57. But there are these breaks. In the meantime, we've got Duncan over here, who's moved to San Francisco, to the Sprickles Mansion, where he had the ballroom. I've never forgotten it.
And to coin a phrase.
And yes. God, you caught me. It was true. His relationship with Jess begins, and the painting, that structure of painting that was so important to all of us, but very particularly to Duncan, was going on there. And then Duncan was writing the plays, too. Is it 55? Duncan is doing Faust Futur, then a wonderful production of that. And there were two galleries, the King Ubu Gallery, which Duncan and a group opened with all the central painters in it, and then another one that Jack was involved in called the Six Gallery.
Oh, yes, where a lot of the poetry readings took place.
And in the meantime, KPFA is a spark of all of this, or it all.
In fact, the Seven Stray Cats did a reading at the Sixth Gallery that I was at.
I didn't know that, but yes, I'm quite sure it was very.
Because everybody did.
Yes, it was very inclusive. Everybody did at the Six. The Ubu was a little different. The King Ubu was a little different from that. It seemed to be more of a. It was a push of some kind. The Ubu. Mm-hmm. It was meant to push art in your face. And it did splendidly. It also made everybody read King Ubu, which has a long history.
Yes, and that long history includes an opera fairly recently composed on it by an English composer named Andrew Tovey. which got its first performance in Banff at the Art Center there. And then
gone to Banff to see that.
And then went over to England and toured there with a theater company out of South Wales, Glamorgan, and I did sound for it. I toured with it.
Oh, splendid!
It's not a very good opera.
You have your advantages, don't you?
if you are interested in Ubu, which you obviously are,
yes.
As I say, this is not very good. But for historical reasons, I think you would probably be interested. And I made a tape of it, and I'll send you a copy.
No. I'm going to wind up rich out of this.
wait till I start collecting.
That's all right. You'll have to collect back. I have to think of things to return. I was at Simon Fraser one afternoon and went out into the mall there where they had brought some, I do not remember the name of the group, but they were street theater people from San Francisco, and they were doing King Ubu. There in Simon Fraser, more of this folding that we're talking about. This is this is going to be in the late 60s after Jack had died, and I went up there, and that big crack. And by then, this is where I hope your book will give me information about all this, what KPFA was doing in the period of, say, 55 to 60. Because I'm back there on the East Coast. Duncan, everything's shifted to San Francisco from Berkeley.
Yeah.
And I just would love to know what was going on then. I don't know.
Yeah. One thing that you will have noticed on this this first installment, that the one vital thing that is almost totally missing from it is the programs. This is all structure.
It's hard to get at those programs, isn't it?
Yeah, it
they
is.
Didn't keep a record, did they?
Well, a lot of stuff was kept. There are thousands of tapes over the years at the Pacifica Archives down in Los Angeles.
I got in touch with them.
And I've got an in there because the guy, Dick Bunce, who was in charge of the fundraising campaign which put them into the new building, down in Shattuck, the brand new place. Not in Shattuck, on Martin Luther King Jr. Way, or King's Row, as it's known in certain circles. he helped me out getting in touch with some of the people that I needed, and I sent him the copy after I'd done it, and I met him just a few days ago for the first time. And he thought this was marvelous and the best summary that had been done of those early years. And I told him about my interest in what I'm doing now, of going into the possibility of CD-ROM publication, which would allow the inclusion of excerpts from the program. And he said, "My God, you've got to talk to the person in charge of the archives down there. We've been trying to explore ways of getting this done, and somebody that could handle it and coordinate it." And he said, "There's money waiting to go into it, and I'll call her and tell her you're coming down there." So there may be an opening here.
No, well, there should be an opening. I think it'd be a wonderful thing to do. Because I'm not
a writer. I went through the English department. I'm trained that way. But you see, I'm a radio producer. I mean, that's what I did at KPFA for all those years. So I could assemble a documentary, sound documentary presentation, both sort of endlessly open-ended and random access. That would allow one to dip in at any point. And I think I would be capable of structuring it in such a way that it would be not just a bin full of items, but actually points which interrelated to each other in a... Well, to me, radio was a sculptural medium. I always thought of it as something that I do with my hands. And it has tactile shape.
Oh, that's Martha. And that's yours.
To it.
The rest of
that's
us are all ears. how interesting. I just think I don't know how far you would go, but you're after this here rather than the time when it begins to move and you've got a New York version and an LA version?
At the moment, I'm just concentrating on Berkeley and on KPFA.
Yeah. How did Los Angeles get the archive?
It was decided to move it down there. Yeah. It was after KPFK was on the air, and I don't know the exact reasons why, but that's where it ended up. Yes, one could
say. One to be grateful wherever it is.
There were reasons relating to who was available to do it and where they were, and as I say, I don't know the whole story.
And what year does it break? Does it begin to spread out into public television?
Oh, television. Well, the point at which it starts to happen was when Dick Moore left KPFA and went over to San Francisco and was one of those who started up KQED.
It was marvelously exciting, especially the televised poets that they put on. Now, that was stopped by the time they got busy and turned it into what now is so much involved in the corporations that, in fact, it even has advertising
you
now.
To me, I turn into a PBS station, and I have to watch for several minutes until I'm sure whether I'm watching PBS or commercial television.
When Reagan was head of the board of that thing, I felt that there was editing of what could be shown. That seems a little improved now. They do those marvelous documentaries, like the one on Roosevelt and so on, that are fascinating.
Roosevelt was on last night.
Yes, I watched just a bit before I went to sleep, and then they did a big one on Nazism that I watched. Mm-hmm. But it's
did you happen to see one on Normandy that was done?
That was before a
Discovery Channel program. That was produced by Chris Koch, who came out of KPFA.
Folds again. It's really quite wonderful. I don't want to, there's no point in really being very hard on, but one no longer trusts the public television. Hmm. And I'm living up there in another country, and I don't really manage to get KPFA, the radio, anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you can't trust it anymore.
You can't.
No, it's... it's become inextricably wound up with local politics in Berkeley, and a large number of the people who are there now came out of Gus Newport mayor regime of a number of years ago here, and it is they are people who are aggressively militarily devoted to a certain narrow segment of the hard left.
Of the hard left.
Yeah.
Now, what does that mean? That hard left.
Specifically Marxist.
Yes.
And dogmatically.
And without I keep saying, from really important thinkers like Jameson and Eagleton, I keep saying, I want you to apologize for what happened to Marxist practice. Then I will be very happy to, I read them anyway, but I will be very happy to listen to you on what it is we may save from the disastrous practice of 20th century Marxism. Mm-hmm. And you're saying it's really very, it's not a renewed Stalinism, you're saying, is it?
Well, it's difficult to be specific at this point because I'm in the process of learning.
It's very complicated.
Yeah, it is.
The left is so complicated now.
Yeah, for instance, there was an invasion of the station a literal invasion of the station by a specific group of the Third World representatives. As a result of which, there's a Third World section organizationally within KPFA now,
And well, that seems right somehow, that there would be that.
Well, except insofar as it becomes a fragmented internecine warfare among minority factions, fighting it out among themselves. And there's a large Latino component doing broadcasting with an awful lot of time, and a very, very small audience of Latinos that actually listen to them, because they're way off in a cloud cuckoo land somewhere on their own. But to me, there was a time at the beginning of KPFA, and it was true of the society as a whole as well, that an imagination of the left, which became a coalescing, a bringing together of minorities of various sorts, in a dawning realization that the enemy was not each other, the enemy was out there and up there, and that they, as oppressed peoples of various kinds, that they had a great deal in common, and that they could help each other, and an apotheosis of this to me was the civil rights movement in the South in the early 60s, when the blacks and the Jews and everybody else were down there shoulder to shoulder, working for something that they saw as a common goal, and as one has come gradually into the position that we are in now, it has become a fragmentation of that coalition, in which special interest groups fight among themselves rather than with the real enemy. Yeah.
That would be non-productive, finally.
Yeah. But I'm coming to see KPFA's evolution as a metaphor of what has happened in American society as a whole during this period of time. I don't know if you've encountered Robert Hughes' culture of complaint, the fraying of America.
Yes, I have. Yes.
And I think it's a brilliant book, because it's not a right-wing diatribe.
No, at all.
But I think he's one of the few people who has attacked this fragmentation, not from a right-wing viewpoint. Mm-hmm. I think he's an importantly centrist, and really his sympathies are more on the left than on the right.
But I always assumed that. I thought he was speaking really from the New York context of the breakdown of what art is all about, and then begins to find a lot of it simply useless and meaningless and all that kind of thing, and then you get big essays on Julian Freud and so on, because he admires Julian Freud extravagantly.
Yeah, and, right. Well, that's another scene.
Yeah, that's a London scene, so to speak.
Mm-hmm, but yeah, I would rather take that book of his in isolation from everything else that he's.
But it's an argument that we've lost our way. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think it's left or right.
No.
People like Rosamund Krauss, for example, who interests me, her books do something quite different that I think it needs to go along with what Hughes was doing in a book like that. She's really arguing that, she began with, in her earlier reign, she began arguing that, modernism's over, that it means failed, or this, that, and another. Well, then she goes back, actually, and she begins arguing that we have not seen what we should have seen in the art. And she, I think her work is extremely good on this, and I think that's true. The thing about the early KPFA was a public means of letting what was going on artistically, intellectually, not highbrow or lowbrow, but a widest possible range to let it have a public space.
Yeah.
Public space is now gone, and that was the reason for my question, was that I wondered where was Cape Epiphany. I'm a foreigner, so to speak, now. Mm-hmm. So what was Cape Epiphany doing?
And all I can say is that it's like the little bits that I've been grabbing out of the air in the course of the few days that I've been here. So anything that I have to say about what has happened since 1956 is highly unreliable, probably.
Yes, but that's what you're working on. That's the fix of the reliability. You know, you've got a book. A real book.
Boy, I know it.
I mean, on top of...
It is great to be a book about America. Yeah. It has to be.
It's a real one.
Can we turn
this off so I can go in there for a minute?
Okay.
The coffee is going right through me.
Right.